Hi, everyone. This is Cassidy Teague with Barrel Horse World and Barrel Talk Radio. Wanted to come back and let everybody know that we've taken a little break here lately. We actually recorded about a year ago this time with the lameness and surgeon at ESMS in Weatherford, Dr. Hand, him and his head tech, Alicia Myers, and we also had guest Lee and Hallie Hansen. It was a great podcast that never actually got released. We had some technical difficulties, had some equipment come up missing. So all that's been taken care of and resolved, and we're super excited to be back with everybody. We have some really exciting things coming up this year at the BFA for 2024 here in about 5 or 6 weeks, and then we're going to kick off things for 2025. And we have some really new and fun things we're going to do, actually, also a kid podcast. So just excited to be back with everyone, and we look forward to a great year. Hey, everybody, this is Cassidy Teague with Barrel Horse World and Barrel Talk Radio, and we are at the Barrel Futurities of America in Guthrie, Oklahoma, and we're at the Lazy E, and today we have Dr. Hand with ESMS and Lee Hansen. How is everybody?
Oh, good.
Doing great.
Dr. Hand, also known as?
Sunny in 75.
I like it.
That's the first time I've heard that today. It's very fitting.
I've called him that for years.
Okay.
Everything's fine.
I agree. All fine. He just calms you.
He does.
Somebody has to.
So, right. Which calms us, which brings us to my first question. Dr. Hand.
Step back just a sec.
Absolutely. Yeah, Dr. Hand, you tell us kind of your story.
Vet school, career. Let me back up, even before. So I went to undergraduate at Texas Tech. I'm a Red Raider from way back, so enjoy my Lubbock, Texas days. I went to vet school at Texas A&M, finished my vet school, and from there decided that I wanted to specialize in some sort of equine, more specific than just being a general practitioner. Surgery, while I was going through vet school, I worked in the OR and got a lot of, at least met a lot of talented people that were doing surgery residencies, and it really fit where I wanted to go with my career and what I wanted to do. And so I thought, you know, the next pathway is getting an internship and then getting a residency, and that was what I wanted to pursue. So I sought out the most, what I considered the prestigious internships in the country, and Littleton Large Animal Clinic has a name from every big name equine veterinarian in the world. At least probably 70% of them spent a year at Littleton at some point in their career. I mean, it's just one of the pillars of the equine world out there. And so fortunately they saw something in me and they asked me to come there to be an intern for a year. And I got to train under who I consider some of the best just general practitioners plus equine lameness guys in the country. So Terry Swanson, Marvin Beaven, and Charlie Vail were the three owners of the practice. And there was three or four other ambulatory practitioners there. But myself and Wade Tenney were the only interns for that year. And we learned more in that year probably than I did in 4 years of vet school. I mean, It was a great experience, really honed. Probably the way I do lameness today is what I learned at that practice, not so much what I learned at vet school, what I learned from those guys and just their years and years, 50 plus years of training when they, you know, what they had been doing that. After I left Littleton, I at the time I decided really enjoyed practice, really enjoyed lameness, but I wanted to, you know, I had a goal of becoming a surgeon and wanting to specialize and become a specialist. And at that time I thought, I really like Littleton, and I was fortunate they actually offered me a job to stay on and be an ambulatory practitioner and stay there. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I thought, no, I'm going to apply. I still want to pursue. So I only applied to one residency. I was fortunate that I got accepted to Texas A&M, and so I went back to Texas A&M where I went to vet school, spent 3 years there doing my surgery residency, and then I stayed on for a year. I taught as a lecturer for a year, and at that point, decided it was time to go out into private practice. And ultimately, I left Texas and went to Gardnerville, Nevada. And I was there for about 4 years and then ended up circling back to Texas and have been in Weatherford, Texas since 2008 with ESMS, Equine Sports Medicine and Surgery. And there's actually five owners now. So there's five of us that are owners of that practice. And we've morphed a little bit. Our practice has changed to where we've kind of created a parent company and or have some smaller outlying practices that we help manage and try to – at least pass our knowledge on and create a good working place down the road.
Yeah.
So that's the short version. Maybe the long version.
No, so much history.
What?
How long have you used Dr. Hand, you and Hallie?
Oh, gosh. I'd say at least 8 years. I think we dabbled. I think the first time we ever worked on one of our horses was at Diamonds and Dirt, maybe their first year. I think it was French Streak and Jess, actually.
So maybe you can answer the question, why do you fly him?
Yeah, what's so special about this guy?
Oh, man. Well, 8 years ago, he approached us at the BFA and more or less said, I'd love to be your primary veterinarian. And we had enjoyed him, and we had a good relationship, and loved what he did. And we brought him on board, and 8 years later, he flies up to us a couple times a year. We send all of our surgeries down there for him. They foal out a lot of our mares. He does everything for us. He's available. He is amazing at what he does. He is compassionate. He knows our goals. He knows our horses. He knows our program. He really has just become an essential part of what we do. I can't imagine doing it without him.
Right. Yeah, such a huge part of, I think all of us as barrel racers realize how big of a attribute, asset, however you want to say it. And if you hear background noise here, we are at the Barrel Fraternities of America, so you probably hear the announcer a little bit. But yeah, such a huge part of your program, the peace of mind, the trust, all the things that, like you said, available. There's always nightmares, it seems like, on the weekends.
Never during the daylight hours.
After 5 o'clock, I always start with, I'm so sorry to bother you, but...
I love that.
But this is what's happening right now in my life. So,
question. So yeah. Do you call him and go through his answering service, or do you have his cell phone number?
Are we allowed to answer?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been in all different types of practices. I've been in the practices where your cell phone number was a very private, very prestigious, didn't get hardly let out at all in the public. Like, it was a block number. If I called you, it was a block number. And then I've been in practices where, you know, it's more of an open friend relationship. And to be honest with you, I think the majority of my clients, they're clients at the beginning of the day, but they're friends at the end of the day.
Yeah,
And do my friends have my cell phone? Absolutely. And my clients, I mean, 90% of my clients are return customers, people that I see on a daily basis or a weekly basis or whatever it might be. And yeah, I mean, my wife has learned from early on that, you know, I get calls at all times of the day, all times of the night. Monday through Friday is not a job, and 9 to 5 is not a job for a veterinarian. And I think it's just one of those personable experiences that when I put myself in their shoes, you know, there's not a time that, well, I'll call during business hours tomorrow. Or I'll answer that call. So in our philosophy of our current practice at ESMS, that's kind of how our practice was really built, the founders of our practice. And that was just one of the things that, yes, we have an office, they answer the phone call, but pretty much everybody has everybody's cell phone number.
Okay.
Yeah. And really passes that along.
With that said, I do think you need to be mindful and careful, and I try to be as good as I can, respectful of both Reese and Alicia, who's sitting here with us.
Yes, Alicia.
That didn't want to be involved. She, you know, you have to, is this really an emergency?
Right.
Does this need to be
discretion.
Answered right now?
Yes.
Or can it wait until it is business hours
right.
or not 7 in the morning or 10 at night?
Right.
And so I do try to be really mindful of.
Absolutely.
If I really need an answer right now or I don't.
Right. No, I agree.
And I think everyone should be.
Yeah. So what do you think, Dr. Hand, is your biggest challenge dealing with barrel racers specifically, since we're all here?
That's a great question.
We can take it.
That's a very loaded question.
You can name me by name if you need to.
And then I want Alicia's answer, too.
So I think if you said, what's the biggest challenge? I don't think it's the clients. I mean, I think that ultimately what you guys as a client, and especially the barrel world, how much it's changed in the last 5 or 10 years as far as how much money is out there, how much these young horses are having the ability to go earn and to go win. It's a big deal, and it's not won on seconds. It's won on hundreds of seconds.
Right.
And so every little niche makes a difference. And so one of the things that I think probably faces the most, if you looked at the, because I think you got to look at a barrel racing community as a whole. And I think one of the frustrating things that I see, especially when I come to the BFA, so many, we're spoiled in Weatherford, Texas.
Sure.
I'm not going to lie. Or in Parker County or whatever,
right.
Dallas, Fort Worth. There are, I mean, I could name 10 veterinarians that I consider colleagues that are, I would say they do as equally as good of a job. Maybe they do a better job than I do, doing the exact same thing that I do. And we're very fortunate for the clientele that live in that area. They have a resource to always take somewhere to get a specialist or a high-end veterinarian to do their job. When you go to, you know, outside South Dakota, Wyoming,
sure.
New Mexico, those barrel racers, they don't have, you know, 10 veterinarians in less than a 20-mile radius that are considered specialists. And they may have to drive 3 hours to go get their horses looked at. Whereas my clients that are local, or when people like Lee and Hallie come down, I mean, we may look at horses once a week. There's always a horse that needs something
sure.
looked at. And so I think that's probably the biggest challenge as far as saying, you know, one is finding a team member, just like Lee said. I mean, I think most veterinarians that work for not even big operations, just even the person that only has a one or two horse, like their veterinarian, their farrier, they're on their team.
Yeah.
And I think that's how you make that a great horse. It's not just the rider. It's not just the breeding of the horse. You got to put everybody together. And that person has to be able to say, what's in the best interest of this horse? How are we going to get this horse to do what we want to do? So, you know, one is just having resources and having those veterinarians that you can call on a daily basis, or you have to fly them out. Like when Lee and Hallie go back to South Dakota in the summer, mm-hmm. they don't have a lot of choices for sports medicine veterinarians.
Right.
They've got great veterinarians up there. There's a two or three, a couple of practices, but, you know, to have a specialist that kind of works in that area and do those things, and not to say that there's not some lameness people up there that could do their job, but they don't have the relationship. So I think when a client builds a relationship with a veterinarian, and that veterinarian gets to know your horses, that's the thing that's going to make a difference. And I think for, you know, when you say what's the biggest challenge, probably that client and that horse trying to build that relationship. Because once they build that relationship, it makes their job a lot easier.
Sure. Well, and like you said, the industry has changed and evolved so much in the last 5 to 10 years that everyone has so much invested, whether you have one or two or you have 18, you know, for the futurity year. There's still a lot invested per horse now. It's so much more than there used to be, I feel like.
It's the numbers are ridiculous. And even when you look at the, you know, and it reflects over on the sale of horses, you know, it
yeah.
used to take, you know, $7,000 to $10,000 horse was an expensive horse 10 years ago. That same horse is probably $75,000 to $80,000 now, or over $100,000, mm-hmm. you know, to get quality horses. And I don't see the prices ever going back down again.
Well, and I know this is probably a little bit touchy, but I know some friends, colleagues, whatever, barrel racers, trainers, are thinking, well, it might be cheaper to do vet work here. But really what I've learned in the long run is it actually costs you more money.
Absolutely.
It costs you more money to cut corners with vet work, in my opinion.
We had, and I won't name any names. I'm going to try not to do that. But we had sent two horses. I had talked to Reese about it, and he's like, yep, like they could do this surgery. It's a simple surgery. I sent them both. Neither surgeries were successful.
Mm.
And I just thought I should have sent them to Texas. I should have just sent them to Texas, let Reese do his job, and sent them back. And
can you tell us what the surgeries were?
They were tie forwards. They were tie forward surgeries.
Respiratory surgery.
Okay. It's interesting.
Yeah. And I think that goes from surgeries to, I don't know if you would say wrong diagnoses or... I don't know. I think it can cost you money a lot of different ways.
Right.
One of the things that I think is crucial, and you two have probably heard it from me 1,000 times. I mean, I always tell my clients that I would rather see your horse every 4 months. And it may take me 10 minutes to look at it, put it through a soundness exam, flex it, palpate it. We have a little discussion on what's it doing, not doing, and we leave. Maybe we don't do anything to that horse. Maybe we do a little bit of maintenance here and there. But so many clientele are just like you said, they wait until there's a problem.
Right, and a big problem.
And they may not have had their horse looked at for a year, you know, because the horse in their eyes wasn't having a problem. Well, their eyes is not necessarily the person you want making a medical decision on your horse.
Well, so and what you have to remember, too, is we ride on good ground. Most of us ride on soft. It changes so much when you trot those horses off on a hard surface. So we really can't. We're not vets, and I like to tell people that sometimes. You don't know. I don't know.
You guys feel tremendous, and I always love.
But if it's to the point where we can feel it, it's bad.
It's probably already there.
It's way far.
But I think that's made the biggest difference in clientele that I can, or in what the impression I can make on clients is that whether it's me or your regular veterinarian, I mean, take your horse frequently and get it looked at.
Right.
It's way great cheaper advice. To do maintenance and do preventative than it is to wait till there's a major problem and go from there. And that veterinarian is going to pick up a subtle difference that you've come in and said, Reese, my horse is great. I don't think there's a problem in the world. Oh, you know what? There is a little something, but we're going to catch it early, and if we address it, that makes a big deal.
I've been talking about this with I think I talked about it with Reese, but Hallie and I. So we have a mare. As a trainer, I think sometimes it's hard when you have a horse that you know isn't quite right and you don't know if your owner is going to be okay just constantly taking them back to the vet. Yeah. And I think that's a hard position to be in as a trainer unless your client is just overly on board and, like, you do what you need and they really are truly fine with it. But, like, we have a horse right now that, I think we did an MRI on her. Reese had to do an ear surgery on her. She's been treated for EPM. I mean, all these things, but it's what she needed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think trainers, sometimes it's hard. You know, you feel a little uncomfortable maybe, or that your owner's going to get upset. But at the end of the day, the horse needs what it needs. And sometimes that's a lot, and sometimes it's nothing.
Yeah. Well, and how bad do you feel sometimes as a trainer when you think, well, I waited 2 months too long, and now there's an issue on the pattern
right
with the horse that really wouldn't have ever been an issue if you would have just, you know.
And my point was to encourage trainer, you know, like here I am with my own horse and I'll do whatever she needs because that's what she needs to be successful. But sometimes it's hard for me to do that with my customers' horses because I feel like it's excessive or they may not be on board.
And I also feel like if your clients...
And it's expensive.
Absolutely.
It's expensive.
I mean, my vet bills on this horse have not been cheap.
Right. But if your client understands, and this is another relationship with our clients versus... And I will tell my clients, I trust Dr. Hand. He is not going to inject your horse. Like you said, if you're checking the horse every 4 months and nothing comes up, no harm, no foul.
Exactly.
We don't have to go any further. And I think sometimes maybe not, but I think sometimes owners think, well, they always want to take my horse to the vet. Well, we don't know. We're not the vet, but we don't want to catch it 90 days late.
Right.
Yeah.
100%. And as much money as we have invested in this.
At this point.
What's another trip to the vet? And yeah, it might be $1,500 or whatever, but in the grand scheme of things and what we're doing for this short amount of time, the money you have invested in training and entry fees, and why wouldn't you just take your horse to the vet?
Nominations.
Right.
Everything.
That's a different podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that we'll get to that one.
Right. Who taught you, Dr. Hand, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, the most about soundness, and you said it was whoever asked you to stay in Colorado, probably?
Yeah, so in vet school, obviously you get exposed to a lot of stuff. I mean, they take 4 years and open your brain and dump in a ton of information. Fortunately, at Texas A&M, when I was there during Texas A&M, I probably had some of what I consider some of my greatest mentors. Dr. Cliff Hannes, Dr. Jeff Watkins, Dr. Kent Carter. Those were three guys at Texas A&M that did surgery and lameness. Dr. Robin Daybriner was there. Those were people that I considered were tremendously valuable lameness. But when you're going through vet school, I got probably a month, maybe a month and a half of time where I did nothing but surgery and lameness. So very small window. Now, I spent as much time as I could when I was off clinics or off, you know, something was slow doing that. But as far as, like, training in that, it was a very small window of opportunity. So when I left vet school, by no means would I felt like I could hang my shingle and say, I'm an expert. Like, sure. I can do this job. So fortunately, when I went to Littleton Large Animal Clinic, Dr. Marvin Beaven, Dr. Terry Swanson, I mean, those two guys are known across the industry. Dr. Charlie Vail, all three of them have been president of what our largest organization, which is called the American Association of Equine Practitioners, the highest group in the equine world. all three of them have been president of that organization, just to say that, I mean, they're the pillars of the community. But those are the three guys that I spent that year of spending time at Littleton was where I still today use the same lameness techniques that I do, that I basically learned off of them on a daily basis from those guys.
Right. Okay, and then changing gears a little bit. So we all know, as in the barrel racing world, there's a lot of, I don't know if you'll call it fads or trends, but barrel racers tend to jump on. What would you say is the biggest myth versus actual medicine right now? And I don't want to bring up things. I'm going to let you answer.
That's a great question. All right, so myths versus truths.
Right.
So one of the big ones out there is obviously kissing spine.
Right.
So when in kissing spine is basically turned out to be the new navicular.
I mean,
it's the topic on every pre-purchase. It's the topic on anything.
Yeah, never used to take, when we brought horses in, we never used to x-ray backs.
Never.
I've sold horses for 10, 15 years.
And it's the first thing now that gets done. You know, I have a lot of people, when they do a pre-purchase, the first thing they're going to do is say x-ray the back. If it's clean, then we'll get to proceed.
So you're starting with the back.
And now, if they've got a bad back, then usually it's off.
And I know I've had this conversation with you before. Just because a horse x-rays with kissing spine, if it's not clinical, it doesn't actually mean, if the horse is in training, the horse is winning, it's not always, from my experience, a deal breaker.
100%. Yeah, because when people say kissing spine, they're encompassing a whole, from black to white type of description of that. So kissing spine gets labeled as a lot. So I think you have to 100% look at multiple things, just like
sure.
we try to do with any type of
language
or injury, is you got to say, is it clinical? So is it truly clinically causing a problem? Does the horse have back soreness? Does the horse,
right.
Run off? Does it buck? Does it palpate sore? Has it been injected? And when you look at those things, and then you take that same horse and you say, let's see what its back actually looks like. Are those spaces close together? Are those spaces overlapping? Is there sclerosis? Sclerosis is really bright white bone on the edges of where they're touching. And yeah, that indicates that there's inflammation in that bone. All of those things have got to be taken into account when you describe, does my horse have kissing spine? And then so many horses nowadays, it's whether or not they have kissing spine, well, then I'm just going to sell them, or, oh my God, they have kissing spine, let's do surgery.
Right.
And surgery is very effective in this disease process when you can't manage it medically.
Right.
But there are so many horses that have 1 to 3 spaces that are slightly
touching. That can be managed.
That when you treat them medically, which can be a combination of systemic medication, injectable medication, topical medication. I mean, there's a lot of different things that you can do, that those horses do their job.
Well, there's
a
lot of horses. I had one a couple of weeks ago on a pre-purchase. I think the mare was 10 years old. She did not palpate sore in her back. She had never been injected. She had more than 3 spaces. So I'm in the middle representing the seller and the buyers. It's understandable because it is such a huge thing now.
Oh, yeah.
But the horse is being ridden. It's winning. It has there's all these. I just think people should not panic and maybe not look for a reason to do. It doesn't mean the horse has to have a 5 to 7, 10,000, whatever it costs, surgery.
No, I think you have to take the whole picture.
Just right, like the whole picture.
The same thing, like when you have a horse that trots off 100% sound, flexes sound, and you x-ray it and you find big vascular channels in the navicular. That's the same kind of scenario where people used to go, oh my God, the horse has navicular disease.
Right.
It's going to be a disaster. Stop right there. Well, that's not true. We know that you can manage those horses. They can be very successful. And back is the same way. And fortunately and unfortunately, when people go through pre-purchases, there's a lot of veterinarians across the country that do pre-purchases. Some of them work on 3 horses a week. At our practice, you may see 20 horses a day. And there's a big difference in the volume of horses you see and what you see.
Right.
And so that person that sees maybe 3 horses a week and they happen to do a pre-purchase and they see kissing spine, well, you're going to get a very negative connotation associated with that kissing spine.
Sure.
They're going to go, oh, I've heard about it. I don't know anything about it. I just know it's bad. They have to have surgery. Deal killer. And that buyer, if that's their vet, they have 100% confidence in it. A lot of times that kills the deal right there.
Sure.
Whereas that same horse in a practice where there's a specialty that sees a lot of those,
right,
and maybe does surgery on them, or is
your perspective's completely different?
Completely different perspective on, is this a condition that may have to have surgery? And I try to tell clients there's always a risk. So when you find something abnormal, whether that's a close dorsal spinous process, whether that's a change in the navicular, a chip in a joint, it's the perspective of saying, I have to put the whole picture together. Is it clinical? What's my risk going to be with that horse? Because sometimes the price that you're going to pay for that horse, the breeding of that horse, the potential of that horse to be an athlete, it's well worth taking
far
the risk.
Far outweighs, yeah.
Absolutely. It says, man, that risk of back surgery or even having to inject that horse's back because of what it is, I feel confident that I've got a veterinarian on my team that has at least led me to believe we can manage this. And if it gets to the point where we can't manage it, then we'll talk about surgery and have a good prognosis. Maybe we can fix it.
Right.
It all goes back to the same thing we've been talking about, having that relationship with your vet.
Absolutely.
Reese pre-purchases pretty much all of our horses, or if he's not there to do it, we send it, you know, send all the info to him, and he either tells me I can manage this or I can't.
Right.
You know, I mean, it isn't, did it pass or is it this or that? It's here, like he said, here's the whole picture. He knows our goals. Can you manage this horse? Yes, I can. No, I can't.
And that's so, so true and so important, because there's so many more pre-purchases nowadays, I feel like, too, because there aren't a lot of, quote, cheap horses.
Anymore.
Like you said, there aren't a lot of $7,000 to $10,000 horses. So this happens a lot. A lot of buyers out there going through pre-purchases. There's a lot of sales, a lot of x-rays taken before, you know, all those things need to be taken into consideration.
Yeah, and I always encourage, like I do a lot of pre-purchases for brand new clients that, you know, they're in the area. So they come to your
right.
house, they try a horse.
Right, we come to you.
They're from Louisiana or they're from somewhere else. And I always encourage people that when you look at when you find those kind of deals, and I try to tell the client, I can tell you what I think, and I'm going to give you my opinion on it. But ultimately, if I'm not the person managing your horse, you need to take it back. I mean, granted, you can say, Reese, I respect you. I know you work on all these horses, so I'm going to take your opinion, and that's great. I'm going to go with it. But I've always encouraged clients when they go and have those kind of things, take that information back to your veterinarian, sit down and have a conversation with them, because ultimately they're going to be the person managing that horse.
Yeah.
And if you listen to me and say, oh, Reese said I can manage it, but you could go back and maybe your veterinarian is not a sports medicine veterinarian. He's a great general practitioner, but he's not a practitioner.
And he may not be comfortable.
He may not feel comfortable doing a little bit what we call advanced sports medicine.
Sure.
And so then you're going to buy a horse that you're going to get home and go, well, my vet can't manage this. And then it turns out to be a disaster. Well, not because it wasn't manageable, just because you just didn't have the right mm-hmm. opportunities to manage that sports medicine.
And another avenue just popped into my head about this. I have a lot of people call on horses that are for sale that say, well, we want a horse that's never been injected.
I don't have one.
Nobody laugh. Hallie's with us.
Sorry.
Now. Hi, Hallie.
Hi.
And, you know, you almost want to say, if you respond at all, you know, you almost want to say it's almost ridiculous and unheard of. But there are people that say, I want a horse that's never been injected. Go ahead, Lee.
I don't even know what to say to that.
Right.
To be honest.
Well, that's probably the second best myth versus truth that
Perfect.
There is out there.
Exactly.
Because,
thank you.
Because ultimately, 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, people used to feel like that once you started injecting a horse, you had a limited number of injections.
Right.
And that horse only had a limited number of miles after it got injected. And so I'm going to wait until the very end, until I can't keep the horse sound anymore, then I'll start injecting.
Right.
Well, what we've learned, and in the old days, there was only a handful of drugs. And some of those drugs are very harmful to the joint. If you put too much of a certain drug, if
too
you
often.
Do it too often, you actually cause cartilage damage. You actually increase arthritis and joint problems. And you do some damage ultimately in the long run. In the short run, those horses do good. But people were seeing the long-term parts, and they're like, no, I don't want
to see
that. Well, 10, 15 years have gone by, and with the advancements in medication, the advancements of just science in general, I tell my clients on a daily basis, that's wives' tales, the old school type of thing. Sports medicine is the way you have to look at it, and I always tell clients the inflammation in a horse's joint. So you take a young horse that is training, their joints are in training.
Under a lot of work.
A lot of stress, a lot of torque. The inflammation inside that joint is 10 times more damaging than any medication I can put in the joint. So if you just say that I'm going to wait until this horse just is really crippled for inject it, the inflammation that you've left in that horse's joint has basically destroyed the cartilage to where now when I start trying to treat it, I'm behind
it's
the eight ball
effective.
And it's not going to be as effective. Whereas if I come in there early and I put the right medication, and so now most of the medication we use, especially in young horses, is what we call chondroprotective, meaning that you use a certain amount in a certain volume, and it actually protects the cartilage because it wipes out the inflammation. The more you wipe out the inflammation, the longer that horse is going to last. So when you start injecting a two-year-old, because he's got inflamed hocks, because he's got juvenile arthritis, you're better off to inject that two-year-old twice a year for the next 10 years than to wait until he's a 6- or 7-year-old and he's got no cartilage left because he's been so inflamed that you don't, that I'm not going to have the success. We're going to have about 2 years to manage that horse before he's not going to respond anymore. Versus if we would have started putting the right stuff at the right time, that horse will last 10 times longer. It's amazing.
And that's a great point. And I also hate it for the fact that from a trainer's perspective, that horse is going through so much. You know, the older solid rodeo horses, they're going to work through some pain, just like a professional athlete that knows what's coming.
Absolutely.
But these young horses are in training. They don't know what to expect. They're nervous. You know, you're asking a lot of them. They're young. So I think it's actually more important to be proactive. What do you think, Callie, up front?
Well, I've noticed horses that we've had, you know, maybe starting their fraternity year early or like a three-year-old, we've had to do more vet work on them, you know, to keep them comfortable, keep that inflammation out. And then when they get towards the end of their fraternity year into the derby
year.
Less often. You know, we're not injecting that horse as much. And I feel that's because we got ahead of it.
Right.
When all that inflammation in there.
Right. And there's also some other things. I know with my derby horse that I ran today, there's the A2 or alpha that, you know, sometimes we figure out other ways to go about things that horses really respond. Sometimes the half of the struggle is figuring out what horses respond to what the best.
Yeah, and there's so many choices nowadays.
Options.
On the market that it doesn't have to be a steroid. There's a lot of what we call biologicals or regenerative medicine from IRAP to Alpha 2, ProStride. I mean, there's a lot of medication that you can put out there that if you have a joint that's questionable, you can treat it more frequently with a biological that is, again, it's going to be healthy because you're putting nothing in there that's degrading the joint or causing problems. And I think what Hallie said is instrumental. Like, there's so many horses that I work on really aggressively between their 3- and 5- or 6-year-old year, and then I only treat them very intermittently between 7 and 15. I see them once, they need to be injected maybe once or twice a year versus every 4 months. We're like, man, this horse is hocks are sore. Well, you got to realize that they're learning how to do their job. It's
right.
A lot harder on your body to learn how to do your
and
job.
And barrel racers,
when you know
barrel racers in particular, flip that. They want to inject them when they're old more and less when they're young.
I know this podcast isn't just for fraternity trainers, but
right.
We are at the Barrel Fraternity of America, and you're talking to two fraternity trainers. I think one thing that Reese is so good at and is part of our job, and he shared the story with me, you know, people want to take their horse to the vet one time and be
right.
Like, well, why didn't you fix it? Well, think of how humans go to a doctor. They can communicate. They can speak. That doctor will send them to a specialist. They will do more tests. Then they'll send them back to the doctor. And people want Reese to show up in 10 minutes and fix their horse. And that's just not realistic. But my point of the story was when we bring a whole new class of horses to them, it's really Reese's job to figure out what makes that horse tick.
Right.
And what I do love about working with Reese is all these, you know, different modalities and different things you can inject him with. He uses them all. You know, I mean, some horses we IRAP, some horses we alpha. Sometimes he wants us to do an adequate series. Sometimes
sure.
We inject with steroid. And he really balances that. And it's our job as any barrel racer, not just fraternity trainer, to figure
right.
out how do you manage and keep that horse healthy, sound, competing at the highest level that that individual is able to compete
right.
at. And I think he's really good at that.
And I don't want to be offensive to anybody, but it also shocks me the amount of horses, and maybe they're doing it before they go home, but when you get to the barrel race, it's too late.
You've kind of, yeah.
I don't want to be offensive.
You've missed the opportunity. And I think it ties in a lot, and we see it here when we come to this, and we've been coming to this for years, where people say, I'm like, well, when did you have your horse looked at? They're like, well, last year. And I'm like, why would you not have it looked at before a giant event? And they said, you know, one of the things is just what we just talked about. They say, I don't have a veterinarian that's less than 3 hours away. I couldn't, you know, and I didn't think the horse had a problem, so I never had it looked at. So, you know, to some defense, they have like, look, when I go, and I have a lot of clients that I see from periodically, they're like, when I come to these events and you're there or another veterinarian.
Yeah, we address it before we leave or whatever.
We're gonna realize that, hey, there's a specialist there at that race, and that's going to be, unfortunately, the time that I have to get my horse fixed. And that's all that they have the option.
But sometimes maybe, you know, now for the kind of money that we run out, I would say make special plans a month out. Get your horses. Even if you're coming to the open race at the Pink Buckle, you're running at a ton of money. If you have one horse and you're coming down here, you can still win a ton of money. Right. It's
so
worth it.
Like for this event in particular, we flew, well, you guys were up, what, 3 weeks ago? Mm-hmm. So we had Reese and Alicia up. They went through our entire barn and got everything ready to be here.
And what kind of peace of mind does that give you? Because you're wondering when you're riding all day, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can feel things on them, you know. And it's peace of mind knowing that Reese has gone over them.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, they might need something here or there for here or something, you know. But most of the time, we show up ready to do our job.
Right. And we touched on this a little bit earlier. What do barrel racers, Dr. Hand, not understand about soundness? What do we get in our heads that we go too far with?
So I think there's two things, and one of the things that I'm going to throw it out there just so I don't forget about it. I think you have to say not necessarily soundness, but you have to say performance. So it's not just the musculoskeletal. In today's world, especially these horses, it's their breathing. And I work on so many horses that really and truly, their poor performance doesn't have anything to do with the lameness. It has to do with their lungs and their breathing ability. So I think in today's world, you have to have a veterinarian that can understand the performance of the horse, not necessarily the soundness of the horse. Soundness is a huge deal. But so many horses I see come in that talk about, my horse isn't performing. He can't do his job. He's, you know, he's got to be lame. Horse is 100% sound. The horse has absolutely no joint issues at all. The horse can't breathe. Either he's got an upper airway problem, he's bleeding, he's got inflammatory airway disease. So that's a whole nother game.
You see a lot of pre-purchases that include scoping with the racehorse side. We don't see that as much on our side.
Not as much. It depends on the obviously, it's something that I try to offer from a sports medicine perspective, because I know it plays a giant portion of the performance of a horse. And so we try to discuss that. But when you're looking at a yearling or a two-year-old, the upper airway problems that they probably have that's going to affect it, that is an uncommon scenario. I mean, a horse that's a roarer, or you find a horse that's displacing or has an epiglottis like as a young horse, that's probably not as common. Most of these young horses, to be honest with you, it's more in their lungs. So it's more of this inflammatory airway disease. They're being a bleeder but not bleeding out, or they're having something. And that's more of a, you know, developing scenario that they have that you just have to work through.
Right. Right.
So from the soundness perspective, I think we've already kind of touched on it. One of the things that's most important is don't rely on waiting to feel the horse lame to take it in.
Absolutely.
I think you have to have those horses looked at frequently when you think they're doing great. Because, again, you guys are phenomenal at feeling the horse, knowing what it's supposed to do when it steps off, when it hasn't been stepping off for 2 months and now all of a sudden it's stepping off, or it's not doing this. That's the time you say, well, is this a training issue that I got to work through, or is this horse actually something bothers it, and the reason it's stepping off is because it hurts and it doesn't like to do the job anymore? Mm-hmm. Well, you can probably train it to quit doing that, but if it's because of a soreness, all you're doing is just breeding that into that horse.
And then you're creating anxiety in there. Yeah.
So one of the biggest things I think is just have, again, falls back to, there's a lot of lameness things, but have it looked at more frequently.
I want to go back to the breathing thing, and maybe Hallie could talk a little bit more about it, but I feel in the past 5 years, I think we deal with just as many, if not more, respiratory issues than we do lameness. Soundness issues.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, the environment they're in, they're stalled, you know, the dust, even if your hay has a little dust on it, those horses, I really pay attention to not just getting on those horses and just long trotting off, you know, is the breathing normal? Are they, like, a horse could be breathing normal, and then the next week you could hear something, you know, that they're breathing a little different, and that could start with inflammation, and then it causes other things. Like, I feel like it causes other things as far as displacing and stuff like that. But if you get ahead of it before, I feel like some of that stuff you can make to where a horse feels better and, you know, they want to do their job. But it's not just getting on that horse to go exercise it. Like, every time I get on them, I am aware of the condition that they're in and how they're riding that day.
One of the things that I think is crucial is, and Hallie may not think about it every day, and you trainers in general may not think about it every day, is that it's not so much did I hear something, did this horse make a noise, it's how did that horse recover? Like, I just spent an hour training that horse. We've been riding for an hour, and I take that horse back. Is that horse recovering normally from a breathing fit? Or is it getting back to the stall, nostrils flaring, you know, and like, wait a minute, like
labored breathing.
Yeah, that horse didn't have a big exercise. Like, why is it struggling so hard? And so I think understanding those little concepts and understanding I had my horse scoped after it ran out of the arena and it didn't bleed. They didn't see blood, so it's not a bleeder. You're missing the boat. Like, there's only, in reality, I probably see every 10 horses that I know are bleeders, probably only 3 out of 10 actually bled out their nose, or you find blood in their trachea or their esophagus. The other 7, it's 100% in their lungs. So you have to have, you know, you have to have a veterinarian that understands, like, what a BAL is. It's a bronchial alveolar lavage. I mean, that's the diagnostic tool that you do to assess a horse's lungs to see what's going on with that. And you have to understand, like, scoping is a huge important part of it. Like, you have to scope them, make sure that anatomically everything's working, because if there's an anatomical problem, then they're going to have more problems.
Right.
If that's normal, then you have to know the next diagnostic step, because so many people I hear, like, oh, well, I had it scoped and it's not a bleeder. Well, is that all you had done? Then
right.
you're missing a huge part of the game.
Yeah, you didn't. Yeah, it's not complete.
Not at all.
Right. So what is your opinion on OCDs, hawk spurs? We talked about tissing spine, but is there any way to prevent these things, or is this just something that you think that is predisposed it happens?
So if we go back to the kissing spine, it's kind of address each one of those. So on kissing spine, I think, unfortunately, it's been there for a long time. I just think we haven't looked for it. Like, if you, like,
right.
I mean, obviously, just what you said, we used to never x-ray back.
Never.
Now we x-ray every horse almost that walks
now
in the
it's
door.
More important than front feet.
Absolutely. So I don't think horses truly have more kissing spines. I just think that we've addressed it and we've realized it.
We're focused on it.
So conformation obviously plays a huge role in that, like how the horse is built, you know, how strong their top line is, how strong their core is. And there's some people say, well, is it genetic? It's only genetic in the way that the horse is built. I mean, certain bloodlines have a certain body frame style.
Sure.
That body frame style is going to lend it to being a little bit more swayed back.
Which varies
not.
A lot with each, right.
Yeah, well, each crossing that you do. So,
yeah.
I mean, how muscular is those horses' backs? How strong is their core? All of those. So it's not a genetic that says, oh, it's going to pass it along. It's more that that's the conformation of the horse, and that's what it's going to be like. So if you said, how do I prevent kissing spine or my horse developing? One is just keeping your horse in shape. Don't let it get fat, you know, especially older horses, not necessarily the young horse. You know, keep them in shape, keep them toned, keep them exercising, because the worst thing for those horses, if they're a little bit close or they have a potential, is to let them get a big hay belly and stand around and do nothing.
Right.
That's the worst thing for them. Now, when you look at OCDs has been around for hundreds of years, and there's so many studies out there where people have tried to recreate OCDs and then say, well, let's correct them, because there's so many things. There's a laundry list of about 10 things that can quote-unquote influence OCDs, and they've gone through and tried to replicate by making those go away, and they still can't prevent OCD. So genetics, I think, plays a huge role in OCDs, where you're going to have bloodlines that constantly pass a certain trait along, and that's just what it's going to be. It's not ever 100%. I don't know any OCD that's 100%. I mean, you're going to have them periodically that are going to show up, and I think you just have to realize that just because a horse has an OCD does not necessarily make that horse not valuable. a lot of OCDs, depending on where they are and the type they are very treatable. And when you go in and treat that lesion, you have a horse that is a rock star. And you can easily put that back to think about HYPP and impressive. If everybody said, oh, my God, HYPP is this terrible thing. We're never going to breed a horse that has HYPP. There would, you know, impressive changed the halter horse industry because of the way he was built. Well, he was HYPP. The reason he was so built the way that he was, the reason his, you know, his body frame won so many championships was because they found horses that you could manage that way.
Right.
So with OCDs, I think you have to look at it in that way. Don't, just because you're looking at a horse that has an OCD, or your horse is, you have a horse that all of a sudden you radiograph and it has an OCD, that's not a deal killer. That's not a horse that you go, wow, I've got a, you know, I've got a lemon. It depends on what it is, where it's at, can it be removed, can it be managed? Because some of those horses will go on to be champions for years and years and years because you took the chip out.
Yeah.
You dealt with the OCD. You managed it. The only thing I can tell people with OCD, especially in the breeding division, when you breed your own, have them evaluated early. We try to tell our clients that raise babies somewhere between 10 and 15 months of age, you really ought to have the joints that are highly predisposed for OCDs evaluated. The earlier you radiograph them and find them, and their hocks, their stifles, their fetlocks, the earlier I know they're there, there's some medication that I can put them on that'll make some of those completely go away.
And
you'll never
it.
Have to deal with them. Again, there's some of them that we know they're there, so let's get them out before we ever put them in a two-year-old program and cause damage to the joint because there's a chip in there.
Right.
So as far as OCDs, the best thing you can do is obviously feed them a high-quality diet, make sure that they're healthy, taken care of, evaluate them early and see whether they have it.
Right.
Because if they do have it, the earlier you know about it, the better off you're going to be.
Right. So as far as what you can live with and what you can't live without, I mean, how... It just depends. There's a lot of things that go into that.
100% depends on the joint that's involved and what exactly, how big or how significant it is. Every one of them can usually be managed. There are some scenarios. And if you said, well, like, what's the worst case scenario? You know, bone cyst and the stifle are one of the things that are that can be really hard. There is some bone cysts that are very surgically corrected. But as a general rule, if somebody told me, like, what's the worst OCD that I don't want to ever see? You don't want to see a cyst in your horse's stifle. Now, there are some small ones that are very manageable. Horse will go on to be a champion if it's made to be a champion. But there are some of them that, that can be a deal killer on a resale. It can be an athletic deal killer. And it, that's the worst one. Any of the others, it really just depends on how big it is, if you find it early on before it kind of has a chance to do some damage.
Right. And I feel like there's a lot now with the prices of horses and prospects. You hear a lot more of it in babies now. Or maybe we're just more aware.
Well, and I think so many people that raise babies, I mean, it's in their best interest. I mean, if they're going to ask $20,000, $50,000 for this yearling coming up, I mean, if they can advertise that horse, I've had it radiographed and it's clean, there's people that are going to step right up and buy that horse all day long versus saying, oh, well, now I got to go to a pre-purchase. And now I got to find out, am I going to find something? You know, I'm going to go through this whole effort of getting the horse radiographed, pre-purchase, whereas, you know, like Lee and Hallie, there's a lot of their young ones that will radiograph in that young age, and multiple clients that will do that. And then, you know, they've got, they've spent the money to get the horse x-rayed, but that gives a little satisfied that they can advertise that horse as a clean horse.
Right.
So much easier to sell.
Well, and it's not always a nightmare either. I mean, I know I've had chips taken out of horses that you've done, and it's, you know, it's a $1,500, $2,000 surgery, and if you love the horse and you're, the horse is what you want, I mean,
it's not the end of the world at all.
It's not the end of the world, and I think a lot of people, when they're looking at a horse, a prospect even, I mean, x-ray all of us and see if there's something wrong.
Yeah, you're not going to find a clean one. If you find a clean one, they probably haven't been doing anything enough to be significant.
Right.
And it goes back to why we're doing this podcast. I mean, you have to have the right vet on your team to manage your horse.
Right.
To find it, to manage it.
Right.
To
and like Dr. Hand said, a lot of vets aren't comfortable. So know when you're approaching a vet what they're used to, what they're comfortable with, what they do each and every day. Because I know, just like during breeding season, some vets aren't comfortable using frozen semen. There's no difference. And some vets run backwards when there's a OCD or there's a, you know, a
couple of places in the back. So
yeah, when you hear the term OCD, and especially like there's going to be a sale here at the BFA, right? And there's going to be horses x-rayed, and somebody's going to find an OCD, and then it's going to spread like a wildfire.
Right.
Number such and such such has an OCD. That's a terrible thing to say, because that doesn't mean that that horse is worthless. That just means that, yeah, that horse doesn't have something. But what type of OCD? Is it something that can be taken out? Is it really going to influence that horse's career? But unfortunately, in today's society, you know, that spreads like a wildfire. The person selling that horse is probably not going to get the value of that horse. Is going to have to PO it, because maybe there is something, you know, unless somebody goes and talks to somebody, somebody's going to get a real good screaming deal on that horse. So
right.
It's all about the perspective.
Right. Yeah, I agree. What are the bad recommendations that you hear in the barrel horse industry, I guess?
Bad recommendations. Well, one we've already talked about, you know, waiting to treat a horse
sure.
until they're lame.
Right, or until they're older.
Until they're older, you know, injecting them too early is bad. You know, that's a terrible myth. Obviously, every kissing spine has to have surgery and is not going to be an athlete.
About OSFOS?
OSFOS is a great topic.
Let's talk about OSFOS.
So, you know.
What is OSFOS?
So, OSFOS is a drug that falls under the category of a bisphosphonate. And bisphosphonates are drugs that there's two cells in the bone. This is a very rudimentary discussion. There's two cells in the bone. There's an osteoclast and an osteoblast. And those are two cells that basically manage the health of your bone. So everybody's bones constantly remodel. They lay down new bone, they take away bone. That's just part of life as you go through things. So what a bisphosphonate does is it regulates one of those cells, the osteoclastic activity. And so when you have horses that have bone bruising, bone edema, juvenile arthritis, or any kind of arthritis, you usually have a high level of osteoclastic activity, which means that a lot of horses are degrading their bone. So there's a lot of remodeling of that bone. So OSFOS was a drug that was developed to balance that change of the bone. And so when you can balance that change, those horses are going to be more comfortable, more manageable, and that kind of stuff. So the drug that was precursor to OSFOS was Tildren.
Right.
Tildren is now off the market. You can't find it anymore. The nice thing about Tildren was that it was a multiple dose drug, so it came in multiple vials. So not only could you give it systemically, but you could also do local treatments for things, and it was really nice. OSFOS is a drug that's just a single-use IM drug. And one of the controversies of OSFOS is giving it to young horses and causing brittle bones and causing early fractures and those kind of things. And so when OSFOS first came out, let me back up. The directions from the label from the company says that the drug, it's a milligram per kilogram dose. So an average 1,000-pound horse gets that full 15 mils of OSFOS. If you've got a horse that's 600 pounds because it's a pony-sized horse, you need to titrate that down. It doesn't necessarily get the whole bottle. But the drug's made to be given once a year. That's on the label on the drug. When that drug first came out, I had friends, veterinarians, clients that said they had already given it four times a year. Mm-hmm. Like they were giving it every 2 or 3 months. And it was one of those scenarios where, well, if a little's good, a lot's got to be better, right? And
it was working.
And it was.
In the moment.
Yeah, at the moment, they felt like, well, wow, this horse feels like $1 million. But what was happening is you were brittling those bones. I mean, you were shutting down the natural body's ability to manage the health of the bone. And by doing that, you were making it brittle, and we were seeing fractures. So there was a giant uproar about not giving OSFOS to young horses because you were ruining them. And I think that you have to step back and you have to understand what the drug is and how it works. Do I give it to a young horse? Well, I'm going to tell you, describe what a young horse. Am I going to give it to a six-month-old? No. Am I going to give it to a yearling? Probably not. Do I give it to two-year-olds or three-year-olds or four-year-olds? If it's indicated. And I think that's where, if I have a horse that has an MRI, or I've got a radiograph that confirms bone inflammation, bone edema, sclerosis, where I know this horse has an abnormal balance of those bone cells, then yes, that drug is an appropriate drug to treat that. Are we going to keep it on that horse for, you know, the next 5 years? Probably not. I mean, it's a drug that we're treating a problem that we were given to. So is it safe to give to a three-year-old if they have a condition that warrants it? In my opinion, absolutely yes, because you're treating that condition. Does it cause a little bit of imbalance, maybe in some of the other bones? It's possible that there's a little bit of a, there's a risk with giving it. But if you have a horse that's got a clinical diagnosis of that needs that bisphosphonate, the risk way outweigh the concerns that you're going to, I mean, giving that drug is going to weigh out, is going to significantly outweigh the risk of, oh, well, how about his healthy bones? How bad are they going to be affected by it? You're not going to have it. Now, you're not going to give it every 6 months or four times a year. You're going to give it once a year, and you're going to get the benefits of that drug.
And you're talking about horses that have a specific
They've had an
reason.
MRI. They've had a diagnosis.
Yeah.
You have a diagnosis.
You have an accurate, yeah.
Giving it as a preventative is not the way to give
right.
that drug. Now, when and you flip that horse to, let's flip that horse to a 17 or an 18-year-old rodeo horse that's got bad navicular syndrome, maybe he has a couple of close kissing spines, maybe he's got very arthritic hocks. Well, now you've got a horse that constantly has an imbalance in his bone. And so that is a horse that probably can live on osphos once a year. Like, does he need it twice a year? Absolutely not. Not the way that drug was made. Does he get it once a year for maintenance? Absolutely. That's an important drug to manage that horse from that perspective. But again, it's a drug that you have to use it the way that it was made to be used, not overuse it.
Right. Wow, such great information. Well, this has been awesome. Lee and Hallie and Dr. Hand and Alicia, I've learned even more. I think that we just need to give a shout out to Dr. Hand, such a great vet. We appreciate you letting us drive you crazy sometimes.
I enjoy it.
And we couldn't do it without you.
Wouldn't want to either.
Wouldn't want to. Yeah. So we just appreciate you and thank you for sharing everything with us. And I know I certainly enjoyed it. So we might have to continue this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Feels like it went
fast. I enjoy talking.
I
get told I talk more than I actually work. So part of what happens with my job. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. So. Yeah. Okay. So we'll have to get him back. Gil says, yeah. Yeah, so, well, thanks again for joining us, and Lee and Hallie.
Thank you,
Hallie,
guys.
Good luck the rest of the week.
Thank you.
We'll
you too.
Thank you. We'll be rooting for you. So, until next time, thank you all.